she phoned the hospital. The nursery doesn't open till 7:30 because our youngest was two. Our oldest was two. So we're like, that's fine. We'll just wait for nursery to open. We'll drop George off and then we'll be there. Otherwise, we can't do anything. So we waited till 7:30 to drop George off and might have been a bit tight. Went pretty quickly from nursery to the hospital.
And it very was quick, though, at
10
least.
Past 8 she was born. So that's how it was 40 minutes after dropping George off. I mean, literally. So the first one, you got ages. Tell your partner, other half, that to, you know,
we
chill
say
out.
That. Amanda
he's
really
ready
quick.
To take his, like, his bag, iPad, snacks, watch the rugby.
I took snacks. I got told off for snacks because I had cheese and onion crisps. And Amanda said they were...
Make him feel unwell.
You should be quite sympathetic to him as well, because sleeping on those chairs is horrible.
Oh, yeah.
Deeply uncomfortable.
I'm really going to feel sympathy for him when I'm pushing a child out of me.
Oh, dear.
I remember Amanda decamped to the spare room, which was quite good, because the shower was in our ensuite, and it meant I was waking her up in the morning for work. And so she decamped, which meant I did get a few months good sleep, which was...
That's nice.
Oh, so you went into the spare room?
She went to the spare room. Because we had three floors. She went upstairs so she couldn't hear me.
Fine.
And that actually worked quite well. But that was like in the last 6 weeks too.
It's a bit hard for you. I mean, I don't know. What do you get, 2 weeks off it?
No, they've extended it to 3 months now.
Have they?
I only had 2 weeks twice. I played golf both times. It was great.
So they extended it to 3 months.
Well, you've got a small baby. They sleep 20 hours a day. There's literally nothing you can do apart from do the washing.
Well, you could play golf for 3 months now.
If only. I'm definitely not having a third.
Are you having a third?
No, of course not.
Even though you get 3 months off that?
God, no. No, it's not worth it.
It's great. How's NCT going?
I haven't signed up to anything yet.
Haven't you? Okay.
Did it worthwhile?
Yeah. Get WhatsApp crew.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can.
Are you
WhatsApp
in London?
You made friends.
4 a.m.
No, I'm in Bristol. They've got NCT classes and whatnot.
In Bristol now?
Yeah. In Bristol since 2021.
Have you?
Yeah, I'm just here all the time. I'm here every week, really.
Yeah.
But it's only 90 minutes on the train, so...
It's good, isn't it?
It's very feasible.
When the trains work.
Oh, yeah. When Great Western Railway
can we have a rant about Great Western Railway?
Yeah.
Is that what disastrous day yesterday.
I had a disastrous day this morning. I got to the station and there were overrunning engineering, so the whole line was a complete nightmare. And then my train got to Surbiton... And it broke down. So we all got kicked off. As I got kicked off, someone knocked me and my effing AirPod fell onto the tracks.
Catastrophic.
It actually fell onto the platform and bounced down the gap. I've got a picture of it.
I would like to see the photo.
We don't need the picture.
Did this person apologise?
To be fair, it was so busy that it wasn't...
Yeah.
Like, everyone was trying to get out the door. And the thing was, there was a train on the other side that was going... Look, there's my AirPod.
Oh, that's really sad.
Can you see that?
Were you listening to some sad music when it happened?
You'd show it to the camera now.
I will show it to the camera. See my AirPod on the
What
tracks.
Did you talk about on the podcast? James's AirPod, sadly. Yeah.
And then I was sad, and then I couldn't get on another train for ages. It took me
two hours.
What,
from like
or so.
trauma or just
too many people.
Get on one?
And then, just like this.
Where do you live?
Claygate.
Where's Claygate?
Esha.
Oh, right, sorry. Yeah, I've got a client that's
It's usually a really, to be fair, usually it's a good line, but this morning was not so good. And now I've only got a left ear to listen to, so.
That's sad.
Yeah,
that is painful. Where do you live?
Twyford, between Maidenhead and Reading.
Twyford.
Yeah, there we are. That's
where we are. So is yours the Bristol line?
Yeah.
Okay.
Great Western.
Where do you get off Reading?
Twyford.
Oh, you go literally to Twyford, fine.
Have you ever fallen asleep to Bristol?
Fallen asleep to Reading.
Have you?
Yeah.
That's not too
it's
bad.
Not too
you
bad.
Get Reading to
Could be a lot worse.
Yeah.
Could
be a lot worse. Should we get cracking? We've got this room.
We probably
12.
Should, shouldn't we, really?
Yeah.
You got some notes. It's good. Well done.
Well, actually.
Look how prepared you are. That's amazing.
I'm always prepared, James. These aren't actually. These are my emails to clients with a summary, but this is actually from the autumn
report.
Budget book.
I had
it. I've
we
got
had
the
a
whole
good look
thing
yeah, got
bound on my desk, actually.
Yeah.
Which is quite
people,
impressive.
People, it always surprises me that the press will announce things and haven't read this first because they end up announcing things that aren't correct.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the budget, Reeves misspoke and said that the inheritance tax changes would apply to inherited pensions.
Mm.
And that's clearly not the case at all. So I'd just like to have some notes. Are they okay being on show?
Yeah. John writes notes as he goes.
I just had a very, very important phone call from my wife asking me which way around we wanted the little sink and the big sink to be. Do you want the little sink on the right or the little sink on the left of the big sink in our new kitchen?
It's got to be on the right, isn't it?
Wow, I'm surprised she even asked you.
I know.
It's always got to go on the right.
Pass. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Taking Stock After the Bell, episode 42, we think. We're here today joined by Megan Rimmer, one of our financial planners here at Quartz Cheviot Financial Planning, and we are going to discuss the budget and following on from the webinar last week, and we had a pretty good turnout for Adam Smith and some lots of good questions. We thought we'd delve a little bit deeper into personal finance planning opportunities, some of the things that have changed that maybe impact on your and people's general financial circumstances. I'll try and pull a bio of Megan from the website. Megan completed a philosophy degree at University of London and completed work experience at an advice firm in Manchester. She is passionate about inheritance tax planning, and she is a pension transfer specialist to advise on more complex pension matters, as well as a STEP affiliate. STEP is the Society of Trust and Estate Practitioners. Having completed the trust and estate planning qualification. So inheritance tax and pensions, I fear, is going to be pretty high on the list today. So I would think we've got the right person for the job. Beyond financial services, Megan stays active, whether in the gym or playing hockey, very good. On a weekend, you'll most likely find her reading a book with a cup of Yorkshire tea until March, when that all changes. But Megan, welcome.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. Sadly, it's I don't a have a cup of Yorkshire tea because we only have Twinings in the office. But
well, we should put a complaint in.
Yeah, I'll put a complaint in, a formal complaint. But no, thank you for having me. I didn't realise my bio was that detailed.
Probably written by ChatGPT, wasn't it? Yep.
Classic. All the pressure now being the expert.
Good. So we've got three areas really that we think will impact clients that we think we'll go into today. The first being the change to capital gains tax and how that impacts maybe general investments and, you know, general investments versus investment bonds perhaps and other structures we want to look at.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pensions, which I think is going to be the meat and potatoes of the event, bringing pensions into the state for IHT is possibly more consequential than even I initially thought it to be.
We'll get into the detail.
And then we'll touch on inheritance tax, business property relief, AIM portfolios, etc. at the end, and maybe we'll go off on tangents as we go along.
We'll see how we get on.
Megan, do you want to touch on firstly CGT? Do you want to see the changes to CGT rates and things that were in the budget last week?
Absolutely. So the changes to the capital gains tax were essentially that the basic rate for capital gains tax has increased from 10% to 18%, and the higher rate has increased from 20% to 24%. I'll be honest with you, though, it's not as bad as we thought it was going to be, or the 100%. Speculation said. It was all in the media that capital gains tax was going to be aligned to income tax. So your higher rate would have been at 40%. But actually, the increase for higher rate capital gains tax is only 4%. I think we've just moved into an environment where people have to get used to paying capital gains tax. And that happened before this budget.
Yeah, so I was going to say that. So the actually more consequential change to CGT over the years has been the reduction of the allowance. Well, you know, the allowance was £12,300 per person, and it's now £3,000 per person, which is pretty negligible, right? So for a lot of clients who had general investments, you know, we could use up the CGT allowance and not necessarily go over it, and it was just it's what you did every year, whereas now £3,000. It's gone in the blink of an eye, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And you must see this managing client portfolios as well. It's you having to have those conversations of if you want us to manage this portfolio and to make sure asset allocation is okay and make it the best for you and diversification and so on, we're going to have to exceed the 3,000 allowance.
I mean, on the whole, the 12,300 allowance used to pretty much allow us to do an ISA every year, make a few, you know... Obviously, every year is different, but probably takes some gains and some investments that have performed well. And you ended up actually being quite close to that limit. There's obviously exceptions to the rule, but yeah, that 3,000 means majority of clients are always going to hit that level. But it's just an active conversation, isn't it, with plants that have assets outside of what we do, making sure we can try and offset where we can. But
absolutely, and I think it's, like you said, it's ever more important to pay into the ISA every year because that's tax-free.
Yeah.
And I mean, we'll come on to other things that people could consider, but the environment now is that just we're just going to have to get used to paying it. It is lower than income tax rate. And actually, at the end of the day, if you're going to pay a tax, it's okay tax to pay. You've made some money.
Because there was talk of trying to bring, well, there were rumours they were going to have a crack at the ISAs, weren't they?
Yes. I think that would have been a nightmare from just a political point of view, but also practical.
So I think the figures are there's almost 900 billion in ISAs, whereas pensions only has, I think, 300 billion. I think a lot of the ISA assets are cash. Still, there's
the majority of ISAs.
There's a lot in there that is untaxed, and you know, the fears were they might have a go at the income side of things.
Well, they could have reduced the allowance. That would have been pretty straightforward to have done. Probably not.
That would have been the simplest way.
But yeah.
But
I mean, it was one of the few things that was a surprise, a nice surprise at the budget was that they left ISAs alone.
Yeah. No,
and totally they've said that the allowance will stay at 20,000 for an adult allowance and 9,000 until 2030.
That's a really good point, actually.
Yeah. That was a good point.
It's just changed the environment. I suppose as well, I mean, not that I can see into the mind of Rachel Rees, but from a government point of view, they want to incentivize people to save.
Yeah.
So the ISA, it does that. For the majority of the UK, saving £20,000 a year is probably not an achievable goal.
No, again, I think the percentage of people utilizing the £20,000 a year was it single percentages?
7% of people 7%. Who took out an ISA used the full amount.
I mean, 20 grand a year to save is a, you know, based on average wage is a lot of money.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. Yeah. It is a lot of money. So it's good that they've not touched the ISAs. The capital gains, I mean, it's not ideal. No one likes it when tax rates go up, but it certainly could have been a lot worse. The conversations I was having with colleagues at the time when it was announced was, would other tax wrappers such as onshore bonds and offshore bonds be more attractive now?
Yeah.
To just explain to listeners.
Yeah, no, I was literally about to ask that. So what other wrappers are there, investment bonds, that might be utilised for clients looking who have cash and want to invest it? How, do you want to sort of give the basics of those, and are they now more attractive or less attractive than they were?
Yeah, absolutely. So investment bonds aren't bonds that you guys come across every day. No, corporate
it's
bonds,
one of the most
government
confusing
bonds.
Things. That it's investment very bonds confusing. Are not the same as gilt.
Exactly. I think of an investment bond as a tax wrapper. So an ISA is a tax wrapper. It's it's wrapped with tax benefits. A pension's a tax wrapper. An investment bond, whether it's an onshore bond or an offshore bond, is also a tax wrapper.
Mm-hmm.
With an onshore bond, 20% is tax is deemed to be paid within the bond.
Okay.
So when you take money out, any gain isn't liable to capital gains tax. It's liable to income tax. Mm. Now, if the capital gain sits within your basic rate tax bracket, you don't pay any further tax when the money comes out. So it's quite good for people who are maybe basic rate taxpayers now. They would have paid 20% anyway, and they're going to continue being basic rate taxpayers because actually they can get money out at a later date and not pay that 20%. Offshore bonds have slightly different tax benefits. They, and it's worth me just saying quickly, you can pay in as much as you want into an onshore or offshore bond.
Yeah.
Offshore bonds, slightly different tax benefits in that you don't have the 20% tax within it. So you benefit from gross roll-up.
So all of the investment returns accrue within the wrapper.
Correct.
There's no tax leakage
correct
at the time.
Yep. And then when you come to take the money out, any gain is subject to income tax at your marginal income tax rate. So if, for example, you are a higher rate taxpayer, additional rate taxpayer, you're a high earner, but in retirement we think that you're going to be a basic rate taxpayer, that might be a preferential thing for us to do. The other good thing with bonds as well, and it comes on to inheritance tax, which we'll touch on later with the pensions, is that you can assign a portion of those bonds to your children or to anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
and the tax bill will be on that individual, not on you.
Yep.
So let's say you get to the point you say, okay, I don't need the money within this bond. I'm going to assign it to my two children who are at university and aren't earning anything. Therefore, the tax will be on them and they might not pay any tax at all.
So they can draw it without paying any tax.
Correct, because it'll be on their own tax rate.
On an offshore bond, you get your 5% per annum as well, don't you?
Yep. So for both onshore and offshore bonds, you get the 5%. So you can take 5% tax deferred, technically. Everybody always says it's tax-free. Mm. It's not. It's technically tax deferred.
Mm-hmm.
But there is that option to access the money.
Yeah.
What that essentially means is tax deferred is that that withdrawal will come into the calculation when the bond eventually ends, or if you surrender it entirely, i.e. close it entirely.
So if you've got an investment portfolio that's unwrapped, i.e. a general account, you just buy some shares and whatever, you pay income tax or dividend tax on the dividends and the income as it arises, and then you pay capital gains tax at 18 or 24% on the gain, which is technically lower than potentially an offshore bond, but of course you don't have the gross roll-up. Within a general portfolio, you have tax leakage along the way. So you're not growing, compounding on top of the full amount, if that makes sense, because there's tax coming out in years 1, 2, 3, and 4. With an offshore bond, I think the two benefits are that gross roll-up, but also the flexibility in giving the bond to somebody else who might have a better tax position than yourself. Mm. And you mentioned inheritance tax there.
Correct.
So presumably with CGT rates now a little bit higher than they were, only modestly higher, presumably that makes offshore or investment bonds, full stop, slightly more attractive than they were on a relative basis?
It does make them more attractive. Historically, they were very popular, and you'll have to see a lot of clients with prudential bonds. The Prue Man used to come around.
Yeah.
But nowadays, they were less popular.
Yeah.
Still had a place in a financial plan. Whereas now, I think that there will be more interest in them, and they'll play a greater role in creating someone's financial plan. It's not to say that general investment accounts are not suitable or no-go.
Of course.
They still have a place.
Yeah.
I think it's just a case of, as with anything, balancing it. So balancing the amount in the ISA, an investment account, a pension, and a bond. Mm. And it might be that the money that you put into the bond is maybe a pot of money that you might need. But if we get to a point and we've decided that you don't need it, you could then assign it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it could be sort of future generational wealth planning as well.
Yeah.
It's also worth saying there's different types of investments that can go into offshore and onshore bonds, aren't there? So offshore bonds, obviously, we are able to manage from our side. And depending on the provider, you know, we can put direct equities in and overseas direct as well.
And they're not as expensive as they were, because they used to be quite kind of the buying an offshore bond for buying the wrapper used to be quite expensive, didn't it?
Yeah.
It's not quite as...
They're not as expensive, but they would be more expensive than an investment account.
Yeah, sure.
And
yeah.
also sort of withdrawing the money would be a longer process than it would be with an investment account, because that's, of course, quite straightforward. They can message you guys or message myself and we can simply make the withdrawable. Yeah. And that's why you wouldn't, you know, I would never want a client to have all of their investments in one.
No, no.
It's about having a fine balance across all of the...
Yeah.
The portfolios.
And then an onshore bonds, do you want to explain what type of investments can go into those? Does that depend on the provider again?
Depends on the provider, essentially. Depends on the provider.
But that typically will be on a platform, won't it? And into sort of is it an MPS type portfolio?
It can be MPS, typically on a platform. You'll often find onshore or offshore bonds within a trust as well.
Yeah, okay.
Because they aren't income producing, so trusts don't have to do regular returns for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you'll often find them within a trust structure too.
Yep. Yeah, and I think, for the sake of time today, we could probably do a whole episode on onshore, offshore bonds, trust and IHT. But they are, you know, for people with lumps of capital to invest and, you know, for retirement planning over and above pensions and ISAs, they do certainly fulfill a purpose. You know, perhaps people who sold businesses or have come into inheritance.
Yeah.
I think they are really 100%. Interesting. And they are, you know, they were attractive before and they are, you know, arguably modestly more attractive than they were pre-budget. But let's park that there and move on to the kind of main event, really, pensions. I guess at the moment, so correct me if I understand if I'm wrong, if I were to die before I was 75, my pension passes to my beneficiary totally tax-free as either a lump sum or as a beneficiary's pension. Is that what it's called? Nominate
Yes.
Yeah.
It is.
Essentially tax-free.
Essentially tax-free. Yeah. The lifetime allowance being abolished slightly changed those rules a little bit.
Okay.
And forgive me for going into pensions legislation.
Oh, we're here for it.
If anyone's ever, yeah, anyone's bored by it, I apologise, but it's important.
Yeah, it is.
So you are correct that if you pass away before the age of 75, the as it currently stands, the pension can be passed on to your beneficiaries. There's no inheritance tax. Mm. And then the beneficiaries can take that pension tax-free.
Yeah.
If they take it as a lump sum, however, there is a limit how much they can take tax-free.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the lump sum and death benefit allowance, which was introduced following the abolition of the lifetime allowance.
Yeah.
And the value of the allowance is coincidentally the same amount of the previous lifetime allowance. So £1,073,100, nice and frozen at a round number. So essentially, if you died before 75 and your beneficiaries can only take the pension as a lump sum, or they say that they want to take it as a lump sum, they could take up to the £1,073,000, I'm going to keep it at that number, tax-free. Anything above that would be at their marginal rate of income tax. If, however, and with a lot of modern pensions, they'd have the option of opening a beneficiary's flexible drawdown account and keeping it in a pension themselves, they can take the whole lot tax-free. Okay. There isn't that limit.
Okay.
For most pensions... it would be the latter, there's no limit, because most pensions would allow them to move it into a beneficiary drawdown account and do it that way. And why would you not do it that way?
Sure.
That's how you would do it. It's worth people checking, for older pension schemes certainly, how beneficiaries can take benefits.
Because if it's only a lump sum.
Yeah. If it's only a lump sum and the dependent on the pension value, the beneficiaries might be caught out.
Yeah.
It won't be that frequent, but it can happen.
Okay.
Post 75.
At the moment,
no inheritance tax still. But beneficiaries, whether they take it as a lump sum, purchase a beneficiary annuity, or take a flexible income, it's taxed at their marginal income tax rate. Given the average life expectancy, most people will pass away post age 75.
Yep.
The benefit following the pensions freedoms in 2015 meant that clients could take flexi-access drawdown pensions, i.e. they could leave it within a pension invested, take a little bit as and when they wanted, but so can the beneficiaries.
Okay.
So them paying their marginal rate of income tax isn't the end of the world, because what it might be is, well, actually, if your beneficiaries are 45% taxpayer, well, let's leave it in the pension to accrue benefit.
Growth tax free.
Exactly. And then when they retire,
they
can take it out and sits outside their estate as it stands. So it was never the end of the world.
Yeah.
It was just one of those things that you could be flexible. And with the children, you'd then have, because typically the beneficiary is the children, you'd then just structure how they took the income.
Sure. And I guess the top down view from the sort of political perspective is that, as it stands today, the pension is an attractive asset for moving wealth down the generations, partly because it sits outside the net for IHT, but also partly because the beneficiaries of your pension can access that money relatively flexibly and relatively tax efficiently. If that makes sense.
Correct. It is, and I don't think I'm saying anything wrong by saying this, as for financial plans, if someone's had an inheritance tax, someone has an inheritance tax liability, we would leave the pension. We wouldn't touch it.
Right.
That has been the advice since those rules came into place, largely. Yeah. Unless there are reasons to take an income, but in some cases there were, but largely you would try and leave the pension intact because that could be passed on to the children or the other beneficiaries, whoever they may be, free from inheritance tax, and you therefore spend money from assets that are within the estate for inheritance tax.
Yeah, yeah.
And the government have essentially said, and why they've made the change that we'll come on to, is they've essentially said, well, actually, pensions are now going to be, from April 2027, they will be within the estate for inheritance tax, because the pension should be for retirement spending. It shouldn't be for people just to accumulate money and pass the wealth on. The money should be accumulated for retirement and spent in retirement. And that's why ultimately why they've made the change.
And I'm sympathetic to that because the moment you've got, you know, it's pretty attractive. And as James, well, I'm sure, will agree with me, where we've got clients who've got big pensions, but also big ICEs and buy-to-let properties, you know, the advice from advisors would always be spend everything in your estate because it's going to be subject to IHT. Don't spend the pension until the end. So, you know, we would look after a lot of clients where we've got different mandates, if you like, the different portfolios. So the ICEs and the general accounts would be run for income, perhaps. And then the SIPs would be run for growth because it's unlikely that, you know, the client's got a big pension and a big estate. It's unlikely they'll ever touch the pension. So effectively, you can say that's next generation wealth anyway.
Exactly.
So let's roll the dice, buy a load of NVIDIA, away to the races, right?
Yep.
So the 6th of April 2027, that all changes and the pension will now form part of the estate, which is quite a meaningful, you know, there's some interesting legal stuff here because a pension itself is a trust, right? And it's its own entity.
It is, yeah.
So even though it's our pension, it's not really our pension in the sense that it belongs to the trustees. But anyway, do you want to summarise the changes?
Sorry to jump in, but it's almost double tax now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you've got the IHT on, obviously, the pension when someone dies, but then the beneficiary, if they're a higher rate taxpayer, they will then draw at their rate of higher tax. So, I mean, you're almost up at 80%, aren't you?
Yeah. But remember, the beneficiary doesn't have to draw at 40%.
True.
So then, well, and provided the pension scheme allows them to do it, which most modern pension schemes would, they don't have to draw.
And how do we think the IHT bill will be settled?
It will be, well, the what's been announced is that the IHT bill for the pension will be taken from the pension itself.
Okay.
So one downside immediately that I can see with that is if you pass away before the age of 75, and therefore your beneficiaries could take the whole pension, let's say they took it as a flexible pension, tax-free, well, actually, the 40% inheritance tax has to come from that pension. So it's paid by the pension administrators. The downside, of course, is if you could choose where you paid it from, you'd pay it from the rest of the estate, not from the pension.
Oh, I see.
Do you see?
Yeah.
But you can't.
But you can't do that. It comes from the pension.
Even though there's a consultation period on it, that is kind of what's been legislated for already. And
that's what
change.
They've said.
So lots of people have said about the lots of people have said about this consultation period is happening. My understanding is it's a technical consultation, not a policy consultation.
As far as I'm aware.
So so effectively the consultation is this is going to be the rule. The consultation is about how we implement the rule rather than the consultation is about the rule itself and therefore we might change the rule.
Correct.
It's very much as this is a kind of coup de grace.
As far as I'm aware,
because I think that the difficulty is going to be clearly if someone dies with like three pensions, who, and you've got, you know, executors and the probate process is not easy as it is. It's another added layer and it's only 6 months you've got to settle the IHT, which is not particularly long window. If you've got to get valuations, you know, you've got to get pensions companies to talk to each other and to the executors. And I think the three of us will all have had experience of dealing with pensions administrators and
every
life
day.
Companies. Not always renowned for their slick administration.
They're really good on response time.
So I mean, it's fair to say that like the technical consultation is interesting because lots of people in our industry, in particular financial advisors like you, will all automatically go, and this is going to be an absolute nightmare for the executors.
Exactly. It's it's the difference between the theory of it and then the actual practical implementation. And we have the exact same thing with the lifetime allowance being abolished.
Yeah.
The theory was there, but it took so long for the actual practical side to implement it, so much so that only the finer details have been finalised recently. And that was a long time ago.
Yeah, I was going to say 2 years ago.
I think I can't see this changing.
No.
I think it is, as far as I'm aware.
And also, whilst it's perhaps obvious to us, it's probably for our listeners worth reiterating that spouse to spouse is still tax-free, right, in terms of the inheritance tax. So if husband dies, the pension can still pass to wife tax-free.
Yes,
that is just
true.
Before we get any panicked calls. And,
spouse to spouse still counts. It might be worth, or it certainly is worth, people reviewing the expression of wish they've got on their pension, which is you telling the pension administrator who you want to receive, because...
Yeah. That is a very good point,
if a couple have got a inheritance tax problem and they don't need the deceased spouse's pension for their living, and we can show that with the cash flow plan, for example, then maybe it would be worth passing it to the children instead.
Yeah, okay. Yep.
It's food for thought. A lot of pension providers will let you add on secondary beneficiaries. So essentially you could say, in the first instance, I would like my spouse to benefit, but if they don't want the money or they predecease me, then I would like X, Y, Z to benefit. Mm.
Can you do a deed of variation anyway on...
No.
You can't on a pension?
No.
Oh, interesting.
Pensions are dealt with separately from the will.
So the two top tips we've got so far are, make sure you don't die with more than one pension because you're leaving a massive headache for executives. Yeah. And it was three, actually. Number two, review your beneficiary's nomination to make sure that that's appropriate for you. And there was a third one that I thought about.
Die before April 2027.
It's a bit much.
Obviously, tongue in cheek.
So the biggest question that I've had so far, and you might be the same, is that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we've got a lot of clients who've got big pension funds where they're run on long-term growth mandates because the plan at the moment is not to touch them for income.
Mm.
A, is that going to change? B, what should those clients do? And C, from an investment perspective, you know, it sort of feels to me like running a kind of 100% equity portfolio in your pension, if you're going to start taking out a load of income, is perhaps not sensible. So it has investment implications for the pension as well, particularly as we've talked about before, we're now in a world of 5% bond yields. So actually de-risking portfolios after the equity market's had an amazing run, and low risk assets are providing a sensible return, not amazing, but sensible. Mm. So Megan, do you want to sort of start with what do those clients with big pension funds do now if they've got an IHT problem as well? Do they start ripping out income today, or do they wait a little bit, and what are the other options they've got?
I'd be tempted to wait until we're closer to the 2027 date because none of us know how long we're going to be on this mortal coil for, and something could happen in the meantime. Or if you do draw out from the pension, make sure you spend it. Either give it away or spend it.
Mm.
The other thing, I mean, it's not the end of the world. It's not ideal for those who are in the later stages of life and therefore do not have the time to draw out gradually across a number of years and therefore spread the tax bill, or do not necessarily have 7 years if they subsequently made a large gift to beneficiaries, or wouldn't be able to be insured under a whole of life insurance plan, which is where you would insure the tax bill to pay it,
of course,
because they're too old, essentially. Mm. For those people, it is very difficult. For people that are younger, though, I think it's simply a change of strategy. Mm. Whereas the pension, we would have said, let's always leave it and not touch it. Maybe it's a case of, actually, why don't we start drawing an income from it when you need it in retirement? Maybe we only draw an income up to the higher rate tax bracket.
Yeah, so you take your income to the 50,000.
Yeah, and limit your tax elsewhere. Mm. But maybe we start to do that. And actually, why don't we have more active conversations about other ways you could mitigate inheritance tax? And we could use your non-pension investments, core, maybe an ISA, to mitigate inheritance tax a different way. If you're younger, we've got more time to do it.
Yeah.
It's just a change of strategy. So it really is on a case-by-case basis of, do we start drawing from the pension now or in 2027, or do we not?
Would you ever consider AIM IHT investments within this pension? You wouldn't have done ever before. Yeah.
Does it work?
I thought that could work. That you can invest within an AIM BPR strategy.
I mean,
within
if pensions are going to be inside the estate, I don't see why you wouldn't be able to do it. Okay. Don't quote me on that.
No, please, full disclosure.
It's just a conversation point.
Well, I can't see why it wouldn't make sense as it currently stands today.
No,
that's
but
why it's
after
never been
27,
done. After
it
27,
make
I don't
sense.
See why you couldn't.
Particularly if someone's got a very large pension and they can afford to take risk with 10% or whatever the figure, you know, as advised is, then that could protect them, particularly if they're late alive.
Yeah, it could do. It certainly could do.
Mm.
Whether that aim port failure will come onto the changes with aim later, but whether that aim portfolio is held in the pension or an ISA or an investment account, it certainly could be an option for them. I think the other implication of these changes, and it was a big blow pensions being within the estate for inheritance tax, is there's actually an additional tax. So there's 40% on the pension, which has now come in.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've been planning for leaving your pension to your beneficiaries, reducing the rest of your estate, and suddenly now the pension's inside your estate, well, actually, for the residence nil rate band, which is the £175,000 each of you, for your main residence that you can offset against the value of your main residence, that's going to be impacted. The reason why is because that £175,000 starts to be tapered when your estate is worth over 2 million.
Yeah.
So someone with a big pension, they might get pushed over the 2 million now. Essentially, for what it means is for an individual, if that pension pushes your total estate above 2.35 million, then you'll lose the full 175,000 residence nil rate band, which is additional tax of 70 grand. If you're a couple, you can inherit one another's unused allowance. Yep. If you're a couple, you would have 350,000. So if your estate is worth more than 2.7 million, you would lose the full 350,000.
Right.
Yeah.
Which again is 140,000 extra tax on top of the additional 40% you're already paying on the pension that's now fallen in the estate.
So you'll have to start doing that calculation, right?
And that's why
I'm looking at whether you actually just draw and pay the income tax.
Exactly. And that's why also I said about making sure on the expression of wish that you've got other beneficiaries on.
Mm.
Because if you've got Mr. and Mrs. and Mr. passes away,
then
if Mrs. doesn't need that pension and we can keep her estate below 2 million, do we do that so she can retain both of the residence nil rate bands and save further tax? Yeah. It depends on the situation at the time.
It's definitely what's coming out is that this has made it even more complicated than it already was before.
Yes.
So if you're a potential beneficiary of your, say, your parents' estate and your parents pass over the age of 75, you're going to get hit with IHT on the pension. You're going to have to pay income tax to draw any money out of the pension. And the pension might push them up into the estate value where they lose their residence nil rate band. So it's potentially a kind of triple whammy tax, isn't it?
And I mean, I would encourage everybody to speak with your financial advisor, review inheritance tax. The rules aren't changed until April 2027, as we've said. So we do have time.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, though, people that, like I've mentioned, elderly might not have as much time.
Of course.
But that's where business relief, which we'll come on to, might
play. Yeah, and life insurance is something that's not used a great deal. Do you foresee that? Do you want to sort of go into how a client might use life insurance, whole of life policy to
help? Yeah, absolutely. So whole of life insurance is essentially you take out insurance against the whole of your life for a particular sum assured. Mm. So let's say we've calculated the inheritance tax liability is going to be £500,000.
Yeah.
We could insure you for £500,000. That insurance policy gets paid into trust, gets put into trust.
Mm-hmm.
And then on your death, you pay monthly premiums. On your death, that £500,000 is paid to the beneficiaries of the trust, and they can use that to pay the tax bill before probate.
And the most important thing you said there is put it in trust, right?
Yes, put it in trust, definitely.
Otherwise, it's another £500,000
subject
to IHT. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And one thing that's important, because you're putting it into trust, ideally you'd like the premium, so the monthly amount you pay for it, to be covered by either the annual allowance, which is the £3,000 everyone can gift in a year, and it's automatically outside the estate, it's not subject to the 7 years, or the gifting out of normal expenditure rules. So you could, I suppose, take out a whole of life policy for the tax that's now going to be due on the pension, and draw an income from the pension
pension
to cover the cost of that, because it would it should fall within the normal expenditure rules.
Yeah.
So you could look at doing that, and also the fact that the normal expenditure rules haven't been changed in this budget means that maybe that's another way of mitigating inheritance tax. Maybe people do start drawing from the pension, not necessarily for them to spend it themselves if they don't need it, but to gift it out of the estate under the normal expenditure rules.
Sort of the gifting out of normal, I quite like that idea actually for a lot of some clients, particularly who've got big pensions, is take out a whole life insurance policy and draw some income out of the SIP to pay the premium on an ongoing basis. Yeah. And that nets the two off and fine, okay. Ultimately, it's a cost, but that's, you know, them's the rules. The gifting out of normal expenditure things, slightly odd. So let's just say I am 76 and I've got £1 million on my pension, but all of my income is coming from elsewhere, state pension, maybe some buy-to-lets or some ISAs or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
My taxable income today is potentially quite low if I have only got a bit of GIA and some savings interest in my state pensions. But I can decide how much income to take out of my SIP, can't I? Because I've got flexi drawdown. So I could take 10 grand a year out of my SIP. I could take 100 grand a year out of my SIP, or 50 grand or whatever it is, and pay 40% tax.
Yeah.
How does the gifting out of normal expenditure rules apply when I can effectively manufacture how much income I get from my SIP?
So generally, the gifting out of expenditure is if as long as you aren't depleting your capital ultimately, you're not spending, you've got a surplus between what you're actually spending and the income that you've got coming in.
Okay.
Mm. It should fall within normal expenditure. Yeah.
So if and I were to take, no, so if I had £1 million SIP, if I were to take 50 grand a year in income out of it, that wouldn't be deemed depleting my capital. But if I were to take 80 or 100,000 a year out of it.
Not as far as I'm aware, because for those rules, drawing out of the pension is an income.
Is an income.
Mm.
So you could, you know, because you can over manufacture income, and that's the point I'm trying to get at.
Yeah.
So
you could.
Does these gifting of normal expenditure rules is going to probably become quite a big part of planning for clients with big pension funds?
It certainly could be. Obviously, you'd want to balance the fact that they're paying income tax on the way out from the pension as well.
Yes.
But it certainly could be. Whether that will change in the future, I don't know.
It
might do.
You sort of try and sort of forward think what's going to happen here. Well, if I take a huge amount each year out of my SIP to use up, let's just say I want to go to 100,000 of total income so I can use up my, so I don't start losing my personal allowance, to gift that, because that's deemed a gift out of normal expenditure, you'd sort of think that a government might get a bit wise to that and say, well, hang on a minute, it's clearly not normal income because you're overdrawing on your SIP.
Yeah.
That's the sort of...
They might do, but equally then, how far do you go with that? So if you purchased an annuity, for example, which gives you a guaranteed income for life, like that might look more attractive now as well.
Yeah.
That counts as income as well.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And annuity rates are pretty attractive. Are they going to form part of the mix?
Annuity rates look better. I think they could fall part of the mix. For a lot of the clients that we deal with, we haven't really looked at annuities, and largely because of the inheritance tax. Because with an annuity, you purchase a guaranteed income, you might be able to add on a spousal benefit, i.e. if you pass away, your spouse gets 50% of that income, but that's it, it's gone. So from an inheritance tax point of view, unless the client needed a guaranteed income, we'd probably leave, if you've got other assets, you'd leave the pension to be passed on.
Okay.
Now that might look different.
Yeah.
It really is on a case basis and would be suitable,
and that is the conclusion I've come to, is that it just got, I mean, it was not straightforward beforehand, but it's got like massively more complicated because a lot of these things kind of interplay with each other, don't they? And your options very much going to depend on what you've already got in terms of your income and your assets and your lifestyle and your kids. You might not want to give a load of money to your kids for whatever reason. You might want to fund little Johnny's private school. You know, VAT's gone up, so you know, maybe Hughie over here can't afford it anymore. So, maybe it's, you know,
well, yeah, it depends. And I mean, I'm constantly telling all of my clients to spend it. It's the best thing you could do. Even before this change, the best thing you could do for inheritance was to spend your money. There's nothing left. There's nothing left to tax.
Yeah,
and you've had a good time doing it.
Yeah.
So it's just a fine balance. I think all it means is it's a change of strategy for people.
Yeah.
And people should absolutely review their inheritance tax position, review what the changes mean to them, and discuss with their financial advisor or a financial advisor what are the other options they could look at to mitigate inheritance tax, whatever they may be. just so that you're prepared and you've got all of the information to hand. You might decide, and sometimes I speak to people and they go, I don't really care. I'll be dead at that point. Okay, that's fine. But at least you're in an informed position to make that decision.
I have to say, clients' views on inheritance tax generally do vary quite widely from the, my kids have done fine, I don't care if the state gets it, to I'm absolutely not giving a penny of my money to the government. Yeah. Look how they waste it. And exactly. You've got everything in between. And so it's very much a case of just sit there and like, oh, I agree.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, my thinking is normally, if we can do some clever planning that doesn't impact your way of life and you can still live the life and the retirement that you want, and we save you a little bit of tax on the way, your beneficiaries a little bit of tax on the way, then it's probably worth doing it.
Yeah.
But the, and I know you will agree, the main objective is, of course, always the client. Can they spend what they want? Can they do what they want first?
And do they have enough to make sure that they, if they need something in later
life? Yeah, do they have? And that comes into the, talking about what are the other ways you could mitigate inheritance tax, gifting. Well, actually, some people might not want to gift that, like we said, because they might need it. Yeah. A big concern for a lot of people is long-term care.
Of course.
And I suppose...
Can that be insured?
Pardon?
Can long-term care be insured?
You can, yeah. You can purchase policies that would pay out if you got sick in the future.
Mm.
If you were already in care, you can purchase what's called an immediate needs annuity.
Mm.
So let's say your care fees were probably in the region of 70 to 90 grand a month. A year. A month, can you imagine? I'm sure there are care homes out there like that. Then you could ensure, you could purchase a guaranteed income, a bit like a pension annuity, to give.
And you can have fixed term annuities as well now, can't you? You don't have
fixed term annuities as well. Yeah.
So could it? So do you think it might become pensions? We never took anything from before. That was always the pot that got left last. Could you have a situation where sort of the general investment account and cash goes into an offshore bond structure, and then you start drawing from the pension instead. Essentially, and then don't draw from the offshore bond. You just take your income from somewhere else because that's more inheritance tax friendly in the offshore bond. Would that be consideration?
Maybe.
You'd have to put the bond into trust.
But then, obviously, once you put it into trust, it's not yours. I mean, we could do a whole session on trust,
so we'll go down a rabbit hole.
Yeah, the offshore bond, for clarity, is still within the estate for inheritance tax. And if you did put it into trust, there are rules and there's a 7-year clock. So it's not quite as straightforward as that. But yeah, I think we will definitely be moving into an environment where the pension will be used for retirement. And maybe it will be used, as I said, to draw an income up to the higher rate tax threshold. So 50,000, well, accounting for your state pension, of course. And maybe that covers your basic expenditure. And then you use your ISA investment account for holidays that I will be encouraging you to go on every year.
Had that conversation.
So essentially what we're saying is there's, even though this legislation is a kick in the teeth in terms of pensions, there's still lots that we can do.
Definitely. There is lots we can do. Yeah. And it's worth me saying as well, pensions are still attractive vehicles to save into. Because you get the tax relief on the way in. So if you're a higher rate or additional rate taxpayer, you get 20% when you make the contribution, but then you get a further 20 or 25% via self-assessment tax return. That hasn't changed. It was rumoured that it would change, but it hasn't changed. And you benefit from gross roll-up within the pension because you don't pay capital gains tax. So it's still an attractive way of saving. It's just the end goal for that savings pot that we've built is for you to actually use it in retirement. And don't forget as well, you've still got the tax-free lump sum. That's not changed as well. Okay. It was rumoured to be changed, but it wasn't. So they're still an attractive vehicle for saving. It's just the use of them, once you've saved that money, is now different than it was before.
Got it. Yeah. No, that's fair. And then, Husey, just to come back to the point I made about, you know, if you decide to start drawing lots of income from your SIP, if I'm 76 and I've currently got £1 million in my pension, 20 grand of income, taxable income, and I now want to start taking 80 grand a year, what might I do with my portfolio at that point? Am I going to carry on running it like knee deep in US equities, or do you think I might make some changes? Or would you recommend some changes?
Yeah, I think you'd have to look through objectives and risk, but ultimately, if the requirement for that SIP previously was just to grow so it can pass to beneficiaries in a tax efficient way, and now that changes, then yeah, you know, we'd recommend probably a different type of strategy where there's more of a balance between growth and income. As you said before, you know, gilts are returning really attractive levels compared to what they have done for a long time. You know, corporate bonds, you know, spreads are quite tight, but again, you know, that's a fairly secure way of receiving an income return. And also other parts of equities, which we might have had a lighter allocation to. So UK equities are still, you know, they still return very good income levels. So there's definitely lots that can be done if there's a change in strategy. And you know, we would never run, we'd never push the portfolio too hard just for income. You know, I think, you know, have that conversation quite a lot with clients, which is, you know, can you get the dividend yield on a portfolio any higher? And if you do that, as you know, becomes a value trap and you end up not growing anything. You know, that income we would generate through total return, so a mixture of capital growth and income, you know, dividend and return. So there's definitely lots we can do there.
I think that's been one of the biggest changes in my career, actually. Yeah. Is that when I started out, you know, you only took as much income as the portfolio generated in dividends and interest. Well, actually, you know, had you followed that strategy for the last 15 years, US equities yield nothing. So you'd have had basically nothing in the US, which has been the best performing market by a mile. Yeah. So actually, you're better off populating the portfolio with a mix of assets and then saying, right, I'm going to take X amount of pounds out per year. And if that equates to 2% or 5%, you know, I'm going to generate that return via dividends and capital growth.
Yeah. And also the client does have, well, if we're talking about pensions, well, our ISAs and investment accounts, a flexibility on how much they take.
Sure.
Yeah.
If we have a shocking year with markets and you're saying, Megan, this is bad. We need to pause the withdrawals from the pension, for example. Well, maybe we look at the different part. Or if they've had a good financial plan, they'll have a good level of cash available that they aren't forced to necessarily draw too much in a bad year. They're not taking everything out all in one go.
And I think the other ally to that, I think another good way an investment manager can add some value is, you know, if we're looking at buying gilt specifically, we can do like a ladder of gilt. So we can buy a gilt, 50 grand in a gilt that's going to mature this time next year, 50 grand in a gilt that's going to mature in 2 years' time, and we can ladder that out 5, 6, 7 years if we want the certainty of that income stream. So in October next year, when we want 50 grand, that gilt has matured. And then, you know, you can do that for 5, 6 years and say that takes up half the fund. Well, fine, you can put some index link in there as well if you're worried about inflation. Then you can put equities as your latter half of the fund. So you can let the equities do what they do. And if they have a shocking year, they fall 30%, fine, because it doesn't impact what you're going to need next year. Yeah. You just have to wait a few years before you roll the next gilt on, if that makes sense. So I think there's, you know, a lot of things that we can do in terms of if we're going to move to a strategy for SIPs in particular, where you're going to be drawing maybe more income, higher withdrawal rates. I think that's possibly going to become part of the conversation.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, and the fixed income strategy that you guys have as well, looking at low coupon gilts, arguably has a more of a role to play with capital gains tax as well.
Because
don't pay capital gains tax on that uplift with a gilt.
I reckon I've been the UK government's best salesman in terms of debt and flogging low coupon gilts to higher rate taxpayers. God, so much.
It sums you up, doesn't it, John?
It does a bit. I love gilt.
You love a gilt.
Do we think that we've done pensions to death? Is there anything else that you want to death?
The changes on pensions, absolutely, but I could sit here all day and talk about pensions themselves.
I'd say, to be fair. But still, for those savings, still a worthwhile vehicle, still absolutely do it. If you're a higher rate additional taxpayer, particularly, don't let it put you off. If you're, you know, if you've got a big pension fund, I guess, it's just probably reconsidering your options in terms of how you generate your income and mitigate your HT.
Yeah, absolutely. And what are you going to do? And just have those conversations and check your expression of wish on your pension as well.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. We're not going to touch hugely on agricultural property relief and business property relief, but AIM, do you want to sort of, AIM's been an area of interest for a lot of clients mitigating IHT. Do you want to sort of touch on the changes there?
Yeah. So business relief investments, and particularly AIM, have played a part in inheritance tax planning, particularly for clients. They've got a large amount of wealth because they can afford to take more risk. And essentially, investments that qualify for business relief, if they qualify and you hold them for 2 years and you still hold them on death, then they benefit from 100% relief on inheritance tax, i.e. the tax is at 0%. this counts for AIM, but then there are also policies out there, or investment vehicles out there that focused on the unquoted shares element of business risk.
Pure BPR.
Yeah, I won't go into it too much. And essentially what the government has said is from April 2026, investments in AIM shares will no longer get the full 100% relief.
Yeah.
They will only get 50% relief, i.e. if you pay 100,000, if you've got £100,000 in AIM shares and you've held them for 2 years and you still hold them on death, you will only pay 20% tax, not 40%. So you do end up, it is going to be an environment where people who have got those AIM shares that qualify for the 2 years, is that still the right thing for them to do? Again, it's something for them to review and consider. I suppose it could have been a lot worse. They could have got rid of the business relief entirely.
Yeah.
You're still getting a 20%. You're still getting a 50% relief.
Yeah, you're still getting half off your RHT bill.
Yes, you're still getting half. And it's my understanding that AIM markets reacted positively off the back of that. So it's not that AIM portfolios are a huge no-go or not suitable, don't have a role to play in the financial plan anymore, because I don't think that's the case. It's just they have a different role to play. And it might be, as with all of these things, and as it has always been the case with inheritance tax, you adopt different methods to slowly whittle down the liability over the years. And it might be that AIM is still there and you keep the AIM portfolios, but you adopt other strategies as well. Whether what you said about the AIM within the pension, that could certainly be something I don't. Again, don't quote us on this, please. But
we'll check that.
Interesting to see how that develops.
Yeah.
Because arguably it would have a place within a pension once the pension's inside the estate for inheritance tax. But essentially, they're the changes.
You mentioned the residence and the rate band earlier. It might be just worth noting that even if you've got AIM today and you get full relief on IHT, that value, that AIM portfolio, still gets added to your estate for the calculation of your residence middle rate band, right?
Yes.
You just need to be slightly... That was something I didn't know until quite recently.
Yes.
Which could trip people up.
It is. People incorrectly think that assets that qualify for business relief, whether it's AIM or unquoted shares, it's outside of the estate for inheritance tax. It isn't. It's at 100% relief.
Relief against it.
Paid 0%. Yeah. So you are quite right. It's a good point. It's still within your estate when calculating the residence nil rate band and whether you're subject to that £2 million threshold.
Got it. Okay. I don't think we need to say a huge amount more. I mean, you're right. On the day of the budget, there was a sort of pretty big relief rally in the AIM market, wasn't it? Fizzled out a little bit since. Not necessarily because of that, I don't think. There's a few kind of, you know, the market itself has been a bit weaker over the last, the UK market in particular has been a bit weaker over the last week or two. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. I mean, from an investment perspective, looking at the stocks that we've got in the Q-Course TV AIM strategy, they're on some pretty low valuation multiples.
They're really
pretty good businesses in there. So
I think the main reason why the AIM market pulled back is more to do with the NI additional costing and
a lot of UK domestic businesses.
Yeah, minimum wage increases, and obviously NI starts being paid from £5,000 now, not £9,000 before. So actually, it was a bit of a bigger hit, I think, than people realised initially.
Yeah.
So, and a lot of the smaller companies, that will impact them a lot more than probably the larger cap. And then there are a few, you know, there are larger names which employ tens of thousands of people that it will impact. But I think the smaller names are more sensitive to it, hits margins more.
I think you're quite right. And that announcement was, I think, the biggest
focus,
the biggest hit of the budget.
That's been, people have reacted the most negatively to that. It's a real kick in the teeth.
It will. And it will also impact workers because it will trickle down to pay
the pay rises
and so
won't
on,
be
and
there.
Jobs being available. Yeah. So it will impact. Yeah. But I suppose, really, to summarise from my point of view and the budget and personal finances, it wasn't as bad as it was rumoured in all of the press. There weren't as many changes as there could have been. The capital gains tax and the AIM isn't horrific.
No, could have been worse for sure.
The pension isn't fantastic, but there are things, hopefully, there are ways that people can try and mitigate their liability.
Spend it.
And
the other thing, the government has one term. I'm not saying... I'm not suggesting if there's another party in power, they'd roll everything back. But, you know, something could be done, whether it's the removal of the double taxation, or, on pensions. potentially.
Because that seems to me, because if I mean today, if I die over 75, my beneficiaries ultimately do pay tax on the fund, right? So it's not tax free for my beneficiaries.
Correct.
No. If I'm younger than 75, I'd say, okay, that's a bit of an anomaly. So, you know, my sort of thinking into it was, well, they'll just harmonise the post and pre 75 rules on death, and then your pension is then effectively inside the tax net. It's not, you know, lost as it is today. So to bring it into the estate was a bit of a kind of surprise. I sort of said that at the outset.
But if you, also, yeah, I mean, if your pension's if your pension's worth 100 grand and you've got a 40% clip on it, so it's 60 grand, and then you're a high rate taxpayer, you're paying 45% on 60. You know, you're getting not much more than 30 grand out of a 100 grand SIP. It's, you know, that is a big taxation.
Yeah.
And it was a surprise as well because it was rumoured that it would happen. And I thought, I don't know if it will because you're not getting an immediate amount, tax bill.
No.
You've got to wait for people to die.
Yeah.
You could have people with 2 million, 3 million pound pensions that don't die for 20 years.
Yeah, yeah.
I would have thought that to generate immediate revenue, the tax relief on the way into the pension.
So exactly. To be honest, that's what I thought that would be harmonised. So everyone just gets the 20% relief and that's
or
it.
Or 30% or whatever it might be.
Well, the Tory,
yeah, 30% was talked about, wasn't
it? The Conservatives put the annual allowance up to 60, didn't they, from 40. So the obvious thing was just bring the 60 down to 40 or to 30 and then stop. You know, you're saving quite a lot of money straight away, right? Because higher earners won't be able to put as much in the pension, get as much tax relief. That's an instant saving, isn't it, for the Exchequer?
Yeah.
But as you say, maybe the pension rules could be rolled back under another government because it's not a tax benefit initially, is it? There's not actually going to be much revenue coming through immediately from it, but time will tell.
Presumably
who knows?
Not. Time will tell, and there could be further changes. There's always legislation changes, and actually, if you've got the right financial plan in place, we simply just adapt it and change strategy, as we've spoken about this for the whole of this time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think my other kind of observation is that for retired families living in the southeast that own their home, you know, to have £1 million, including your pensions, does not go a long way, does it?
No, not with house prices.
So the sort of stat that's often quoted is only 6% of estates pay IHT. I mean, we live in the southeast bubble for sure, and we need to be, you know, careful and mindful of what's happening across the country. But that number is only going one way, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the nil rate band, which is the 325,000. If your estate's below that, you don't pay inheritance tax. And then the residence nil rate band of 175,000 has been frozen as well until 2030.
Sad news for pod listeners, though. The British ice has been canned, which I was disappointed about because we were
excited about the Bricer.
Yeah, the Bricer.
The Bricer.
didn't last long.
Sat here
we got a couple of pods on the Bricer and that was it.
We
and
did,
then it was tinned.
So. Sat here with our Make the UK Stock Market Great Again caps on. I see 10,000 of my lifetime.
We do need caps. We need red caps, green caps.
Yeah.
Quarter green caps.
Green caps. we should probably wrap it there, should we? Anything else? Any other?
No, I think
thoughts?
That's it, really. Yeah, I could be here all day.
Could be
really.
Here all day. Well, that's fine with me.
Yeah.
Good. Well, thank you, Megan.
You're most welcome.
James.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Pleasure. Thank you, everyone, for watching and listening today. Any questions, let us know on jonathan.raymond@quartercheviot.com. And any, you know, major issues with pensions and IHT and all that sort of stuff, get in touch with a good, competent financial advisor. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.